The Orb, Volume 1, Number 8. Forecasting. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. Picking up from our last episode and our reluctance to engage with science, this time we're looking at our love affair with expert predictions. What happened to the robot maids and flying cars? Where did that future go? Why can't we get it right? In spite of the misses, we continue to seek predictions to give us hope, or at least comfort, that we have a future. Let's start small. Most of us are familiar with checking a weather forecast. Regardless of the jokes, we generally do heed what they say with respect to the near term. Long-term weather forecasting, not so much. But we generally heed them when planning for the day ahead. It can get to be a coin flip when they give us something like cloudy with 40% chance of showers. Just what does that mean? In fact, what it means is, checking our past records of when we had these same preconditions, 40% of those times, it rained. The weather office favors accuracy over certainty. As discussed in our episode on fear, we don't do uncertainty very well. Bill Clinton famously said, "When people feel uncertain, they'd rather have somebody that's strong and wrong than somebody who's weak and right."
The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb, and with fissile material, could build one within a year.
Someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun. It's certain that we will have waited too long.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
Take action before it's too late.
We would be seen as liberators in Iraq.
We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north.
Our people are going to find out the truth, and the truth will say that this intelligence is good intelligence, no doubt in my mind.
We will in fact find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive.
I think what will happen is we'll discover people who will tell us where to go find it.
We won't be proven wrong.
So the money's going to come from Iraqi oil revenue, as everyone has said.
Over time, the truth will come out.
We did not have perfect foresight into what we were going to find in Iraq.
Foresight is not perfect. In fact, much of what passes for expert predictions are worse than what you would get with a coin flip. Really, there are studies. On BBC Radio 4's program All in the Mind, broadcast on June 15, 2011, the host, Claudia Hammond, discussed prediction with psychologist Dylan Evans and Dan Gardner, author of Future Babble, Why Expert Predictions Fail and Why We Believe Them Anyway.
I began by asking Dan Gardner just how wrong experts have got it in the past.
Oh, sure. There's an endless litany of failed predictions. In fact, you could fill a whole library with nothing but failed predictions. Some of them are famous, such as the many experts who said that there would never again be another major European war shortly before the First World War broke out. There was Irving Fisher, the great American economist, who said that in 1929, of course, stocks had reached a permanently high plateau shortly before the crash. There was a virtual expert consensus in the late 1980s and early 1990s that Japan would overtake the United States and become the world's number one economy. Like I say, it's an endless litany.
I liked the experiment that The Economist did in the 1980s with various former finance ministers, company chairmen and dustmen, and they got them to give 10-year economic forecasts, and the finance ministers didn't come out very well, but the dustmen did just as well as the company chairman. So is there just not such a thing as an expert, really?
Well, I don't go that far. I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to say that experts know nothing. I think that's a terrible mistake. But it is true that prediction of the sort that we're interested in, predicting economies, predicting elections, wars, it's extremely difficult. And simply being an expert in the subject is no guarantee of accuracy. By the way, I should, of course, mention that while it's easy for me to run off a list of examples of failed expert predictions, of course, I haven't actually proved my point that expert predictions routinely fail by simply telling you anecdotes. In order to do that, what you have to do is you have to have an experiment. You have to have quite an elaborate and exhaustive experiment, which fortunately it's already been done. It's been done by an eminent psychologist named Philip Tetlock. Philip Tetlock brought together a group of about 280 experts. They were economists, political scientists, intelligence analysts, journalists, people whose job involved forecasting to some uh, some degree. And he asked them about 28,000 predictions in all, about all the sorts of things that they make predictions about anyway, the economy, the inflation rate, elections, wars. And so time passed, he analyzed the accuracy of the predictions, and he came to the conclusion that the average expert was about as accurate as random guessing, or if you prefer a more colorful metaphor, about as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee. Cynics like to emphasize that first conclusion of Tetlock's research, that the average expert was no better than a flipped coin. But they don't emphasize the second point. I think the second point's just as important, perhaps even more important, which is that there was actually two statistically significant groups of experts. One group was actually less accurate than random guessing. They actually would have improved their outcomes if they had flipped a coin. But the other group had real predictive insight. Now, they were, and it was modest predictive insight. They were still miles and miles and miles from perfect, but they had real predictive insight. And that is a real interesting illustration of a critical point.
Well, so Dylan, if I can bring you in here, what do you think that that does mean? Does that mean there are a few people who just happen to have a genius for prediction, or are some people using different strategies?
Well, I think that Tetlock's, he draws a distinction between what he calls foxes and hedgehogs, and that there does seem to be a different kind of style of thinking in some experts, which is much more cautious and humble, if you like. And these people, which Tetlock calls the foxes, tend to be a lot better at making predictions than the hedgehogs.
What Dylan Evans does not mention is the nature of the hedgehogs, their style of thinking, that makes them even worse than dart-throwing monkeys. Let's start with a little methodology so we can understand how Tetlock arrived at his conclusions. The questions and answers had to be clear with unambiguous pass-fail criteria. The experts had to rate the probability they would be right using a specific percentage. To calibrate the results, an expert that gave a set of predictions with a 70% confidence had to be right on 70% of those predictions. To provide some discrimination of a quality prediction from a lucky guess, experts that expressed greater confidence and got it right were weighted more heavily than those that got the prediction correct, but with a lower level of confidence. There was a benchmark set by using a variety of simple and arbitrary rules, such as there will be no change. These benchmarks were used to compare whether the experts did any better than a set of arbitrary choices. Predictions covered short, medium, and long-term spans, from 1 or 2 years up to 20 years out. Then came the waiting for reality to catch up. The study began in 1984. 284 experts, 27,450 predictions, and 20 years later, the results are in. On calibration, the accuracy of the predictions, the experts would have been better off making random guesses. Broadly, they were no better than monkeys throwing darts. However, on discrimination, the results were much more interesting. As stated in the clip, Tetlock discovered two groups of predictors that he classed as foxes and hedgehogs. The foxes were the ones that were cautious. The hedgehogs were decisive and confident. The choices of foxes and hedgehogs comes from a fragment of an ancient Greek poem by Archilochus. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. What distinguishes the groups, the impressive foxes from the borderline delusional hedgehogs, is not political beliefs, optimism or pessimism, training, or access to resources. What made the difference was how they think. The hedgehogs were the least comfortable with complexity and uncertainty. They wanted to keep it simple and stupid. By reducing the problems to a simple core theme that they were comfortable with, they would use it as a template to solve any problem. By having a deep-rooted belief in one big idea, they would consequently have exceptionally high confidence in predictions that followed that core belief. The foxes did not use templates. They drew information from multiple sources and synthesized a result. They constantly questioned both their sources and themselves. They tried to separate perception from reality. That is a particularly important point, as I'll get to later. Tetlock's results were unequivocal. The foxes beat the hedgehogs on both calibration and discrimination. Complex and cautious thinking trounced simple and confident belief. His data also showed that the more ideologically extreme the hedgehog, the worse their predictions. Claudia Hammond continues to discuss with Dan Gardner why we still believe the monkeys, or hedgehogs.
Dan, it's easy for us to say all the experts are no good at it, but we're the ones who believe them and who go back to them for more advice and who get people to make these predictions in the first place. We want our politicians to be able to tell us what will happen. Isn't it our fault?
Oh, absolutely. It's a demand-side problem. Human beings have a fundamental psychological aversion to uncertainty. It's extremely disturbing, particularly in uncertain times, to look into the future and realize you don't know what's coming next. And so you go looking for certainty in various places. For example, there is research that shows that belief in superstition rises during particularly uncertain times. Well, another form of certainty is, of course, the expert prediction. If you believe the expert knows what's going to come, then you can derive certainty from his or her prediction. That's very psychologically satisfying. But here's the tricky part. The sort of expert who is extremely confident that they know what's going to come is, as demonstrated in Philip Tetlock's research, precisely the sort of expert that we should not be listening to. They're the sort of expert who is most likely to be wrong. It's the type of expert who says, I think on a balance of probabilities that it is more likely than not that something is going to happen, but I can see countervailing factors. It's, in other words, it's the sort of expert who gives you that very dissatisfying response, that very hedged response, who is more likely to be right. They don't satisfy our psychological craving for certainty, and so we tend not to seek them out, and that's a terrible mistake. In fact, in Philip Tetlock's research, he showed that there was an inverse correlation between fame and accuracy. The more famous the expert was, the less accurate he was, and that's because the media and the public are turning to the wrong sorts of experts. You can test this yourself by asking yourself, when you listen to talking heads on the radio, on television, how often do you hear the phrase, I don't know? Well, we know from the research literature that saying, I don't know, acknowledging the limitations of your knowledge, is absolutely essential to good judgment, and yet you never hear that.
As a result, we put up with, we even reward, pundits that are wildly inaccurate, but tell simple narratives and are profoundly sure of themselves. We cleave to them over those scientist types with all their equivocations and probabilities, jargon and techno-babble. Just give it to me straight. I don't want to have to think about it. That's why I'm listening to you.
And God says, then sudden destruction is coming upon them. Now, I did not arrange that language. That's in the Bible. That's from the mouth of God. So this matter of really believing that we're right on the threshold of Judgment Day and that it's going to be May 21 is a tremendously important piece of information.
Okay, I'm not really listening to Harold Camping, but you do have to admire his conviction.
There's just no reason in the world, no possibility, that it will not happen.
There must be other features of predictions beyond the confidence of the expert that draw us to them. There are a few things we want in our predictions. One, confidence from the expert. We've covered that. Two, a simple narrative. We don't want to have to think too hard about anything. Take Y2K as an example. The narrative was simple. Computers with only two digits for the year would think 2000 was actually 1900, and really bad things would happen. That's easy to understand without thinking. Keep it simple and stupid. 3. Concurrence. We like to have our own beliefs confirmed. This is called confirmation bias. If the prediction agrees with the one big idea we already believe, then it must also be right. Camping's prediction that the end of the world would come on May 21st, 2011, could only ring true for people who already had a belief that the end times were upon us. For most of us, our preconception is that biblical end times is either a complete fantasy or something too distant to be concerned about. Our perception of reality keeps changing. So we get new predictions. The revolution is near.
The word is about There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
I'd like to return now to something mentioned earlier, separating perception from reality. The foxes try to find the underlying reality, while hedgehogs are satisfied with their perceptions, whether real or imagined. Working on perceptions instead of reality can often deliver self-fulfilling prophecies. W.I. Thomas, an American sociologist, developed the Thomas theorem, which states that if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences. What you believe about something, whether true or not, decides your actions. Those actions are real and result in real, true consequences. A simple and classic example is a bank run. The bank does not have to actually be insolvent. If enough account holders believe that it is, it soon becomes true. Adopting this understanding, we get real-world financial and monetary policy developed to manage inflation. In the expectations models of economic inflation, people's expectations of higher prices in the future lead them to spend more today and demand higher interest rates on savings. These behaviors, in turn, create inflationary pressure and can cause inflation. Business reporting requires optimistic forecasts for the same reasons. If we hear financial experts predicting a contraction of stock values, people will start selling stocks and fulfilling the prediction. Only with positive forecasts can we realize rising market values. An example of self-fulfilling prophecy in politics is the relationship between the USA and Cuba. While initially the US had offered support and encouragement to Castro, that quickly soured as Castro began expropriating lands owned by such companies as United Fruit. Castro struck a deal in February 1960 to purchase oil from the USSR, and when US refineries in Cuba refused to process that oil, he expropriated their facilities. This led the US to break off diplomatic relations. America's fear that Cuba would become a Soviet satellite led to a policy of ostracizing the regime, thus effectively driving Cuba into a Soviet alliance as its only option for national security. Self-fulfilling prophecies don't always have to lead to bad ends. A famous example includes a study where teachers were told arbitrarily that random students were going to blossom. Those random students actually ended the year with significantly greater improvements than their peers. Perception changed reality. Of course, it's the bad results that stick in our memory. Here's Bill Maher from his show Real Time in October 2006. My apologies for the sound quality. It's still worth it.
And finally, new rule in two parts. A, you can't call yourself a think tank if all your ideas are stupid. And B, if you're someone from one of the think tanks that dreamed up the Iraq War and who predicted that we'd be greeted as liberators and that we wouldn't need a lot of troops and that Iraqi oil would pay for the war, that the WMDs would be found, that the looting wasn't problematic, that the mission was accomplished, that the insurgency was in its last throes, that things would get better after the people voted, after the government was formed, after we got Saddam, after we got his kids, after we got Sarkawi, and that the whole bloody mess wouldn't turn into a civil war, you have to stop making predictions. Richard Perle thought we could win Iraq with 40,000 troops. Paul Wolfowitz predicted in 2003 that within a year the grateful people of Baghdad would name some grand square in their fine city after President Bush. And he was right when he said they'd be waving American flags. They were on fire. And now Mr. Crystal proposes immediate military action against Iran, predicting the Iranians will thank us for it. Hey, you know what, Nostradamus? Why don't you sit this one out? We'll get by using the magic eight ball for a while. Because you guys have been so wrong about so much for so long, people are actually turning to the Democrats.
What more can I say? The future shall remain unknowable. Embrace the mystery. Let life reveal itself in its own good time. If you must seek out predictions, or most importantly, if you must seek leaders to guide you into the future, don't pick the extremist ideological ones that have it all figured out. They're worse than monkeys with darts.
Thank you.
Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.